I'm Evan Kleinman from Angeli Cafe, and this is Good Food on KCRW. Have you ever heard of meat glue? It's what holds those chicken pieces into cute shapes, and it's being used in high-tech foods. I'll tell you about it today. And are you a gin drinker? Vodka may have surpassed gin in popularity, but the smell and taste of those juniper berries can really make you swoon. I'll convince you later in the show. Plus a ban on outdoor grilling in Glendale and trans fats in New York City. First, let's get to the farmers markets to see what's in season this week.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report, and I'm talking to Duke Richardson, who's the owner of Rancho Levina Walnut Company, and he also makes walnut oil. So let's first of all, Duke, let's talk about the variety of walnuts you grow, what makes them so special, and then let's talk about the process of making walnut oil.
Our walnut orchard was actually planted in 1906. It's a variety of coastal walnut, a variety of the English walnut, and it's actually called the Payne walnut, P-A-Y-N-E.
All right, and then when is the harvest season for the walnuts?
Harvest season is usually in about September. I mean, it's in the fall, September, October, and these nuts that we have here were probably on the tree 3 weeks ago.
Oh, wow. And they're considered a white meat walnut?
It is, yeah. It's lighter in color than, and it's very different from the black walnut. Much lighter, and it's much sweeter than the black walnut or the English walnut.
Okay. And then now the oil. Tell us how you do the oil.
The oil is, we use a hydraulic press. It's cold pressed, and it's just a one-time press, and whatever comes out of it goes through a filter, and then it goes into the oil. So it actually takes about 3.5 pounds of walnut meat to make the one 500 milliliter cans.
Okay.
So
do we have to refrigerate them when we get them home?
Once it's opened, it needs to be refrigerated to last, it has about a 6 to 7 month shelf life.
Okay. And what do people use it for?
Use it as, it's wonderful as a salad dressing, as a butter replacement, garnish over to toss your pasta, over rice, over potatoes. It's also wonderful as a marinade. It's great on fish. It's wonderful in cookies or in brownies or in cake. It has a nice nutty flavor to it. I mean, you can do the same thing you can with olive oil, but it has a little better flavor. It's a sweeter flavor, a little nuttier flavor. And then it's also much higher in omega-3s and 6s.
Oh.
So it's third only to flaxseed oil and fish oil.
And so what is a smoke point on this?
The smoke point is about 400 degrees. The oil will actually start to, it will start smoking. And then it does change from unsaturated fat to saturated fat, and that's the unhealthy fatty acid. But I wouldn't do any frying with it.
Okay. All right, great. And you're here at the Wednesday market. What other markets do you go to?
We do Santa Barbara County.
Okay.
We do 5 markets up there. Tuesday, Friday, Montecito. Saturday morning in downtown Santa Barbara, and Sunday in Goleta.
Okay, where is your farm located?
It is on Santa Rosa Road, right in the middle of the wine country in North Santa Barbara County. If you saw the movie Sideways, there is one scene where the four characters in the movie have the picnic under the walnut orchard, or in the walnut orchard under the walnut trees, and that is our orchard. So.
Oh, how nice. All right, Duke, well, this is great. We're happy to have you here, and walnut oil is something we just haven't had before, so we're happy to have it.
Thank you very much.
That was Duke Richardson. He's the owner of Rancho Levina Walnut Ranch, and he's bringing in fresh shelled walnuts from the 2006 harvest and wonderful bottles of walnut oil. We're visiting now with Barbara Wyman, who comes down with Tutti Frutti Farms from Lompoc. Tutti Frutti is a well-known organic farm, been coming to the market for years. And, you know, in a way, Barbara, it still looks like it's late summer out here. You've got a beautiful display with peppers, bright yellow tomatoes, and then you go over into your fall crops, which are looking better than ever. But let's talk about some stuff that we're going to be able to enjoy for the months ahead. Let's talk about red carrots, the yellow carrots, the purple carrots.
Yeah, the carrots are the one thing that we have on the table that we will have for a while. We have the yellow, the really sweet, light-flavored ones, the orange, and then the purple ones, which are a high mineral content carrot, less sugar, a bit more minerals, better for cooking.
And let's talk, too, about your winter squashes that you have down there.
Yeah, we have the butternut, we have kabocha, we even have an orange kabocha that looks like a pumpkin, but it's an orange kabocha.
Okay, and the kabocha is the squash. It also comes in green, and it's one of the sweetest of the winter squashes.
It is. I think it has the best flavor of all the squashes. It is drier. It has that dry, flaky texture instead of that watery texture that other squashes, which I think also helps concentrate the flavor.
Right, and they can be cooked any number of ways. They can be cooked just roasted whole in the oven. If you really want to do it simple, you can cut them in half and roast them. You can steam them. You could probably saute them in a pan, for that matter.
Another thing for raw food is taking that, we can do it with butternut or kabocha, put it in a blender with a raw agave, honey, cinnamon, cloves, and blend it into like a raw pudding, and it comes out really good.
And agave is what, a cactus?
Yeah, it's a cactus sweetener. It's very popular in the raw food sweeteners.
All right, Barbara. Well, as always, it's great to chat with you, and your stand is looking good. That was Barbara Wyman, and she works with Tutti Frutti Farms, and they have the beautiful root crops, everything looking really hearty and healthy and ready for soup. Jeff Riegert from Penryn Farms is finally bringing in his hand-massaged, hand-cured hoshigaki whole-dried hachia persimmons. This is an ancient Japanese art that only Jeff practices on his persimmon ranch. The persimmon, it's a fall fruit. It's the beautiful orange color. But a hoshigaki is a method of taking a not-quite-soft persimmon, peeling it, which is difficult in itself, and then hanging it on fishing line and then massaging it over the course of several weeks so it dries uniformly, smooth and even and soft, and then this beautiful dusting of powdery white sugar comes to the surface of the fruit. They're very popular in Japan to be given as gifts, and it's a delicious artisanal taste treat that only Penryn Orchards is producing right now. So come on by and get some of those. They're beautifully packaged for the holidays, or you can just enjoy them yourself and eat them like a snack. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
With James Bond in the theaters, it's hard not to consider the martini. Martinis are really popular these days. Vodka's taken over as the main ingredient, and I really think that's just too bad. Personally, I think a real martini is made with gin. That juniper berry smell just sends me reeling. But not all gins are created equally. I'll be back next on Good Food with a taste of Plymouth gin. Right, I'll confess, I used to be a vodka drinker. My martinis weren't purest martinis. Instead, they were filled with a smooth, nearly tasteless spirit. Then I changed. Maybe age caused me to desire more complexity. But all of a sudden, I found myself craving gin martinis. The lovely sparkling GNT, that's gin and tonic for you neophytes. And all of a sudden I noticed that certain bars, which pride themselves on a quality drink, were stocking gins that I had never heard of before, like Plymouth gin. So I got curious and invited Simon Ford to Good Food. Simon is brand relations manager for Plymouth gin, and before joining Plymouth, he established some of London's finest cocktail bars. Let's start with what is gin. Tell us what gin is.
If you were going to look at gin in a very simple term, it would be a juniper-flavored spirit. But as most bartenders and sort of most connoisseurs know, it's a lot more than that. Juniper is obviously the main ingredient to gin. But after juniper, all the different brand companies actually have their own recipes, some of them very ancient, some of them very new. And these contain what we call botanicals, which are the herbs and spices that have been gathered from around the world.
Tell us what London dry gin is, that sort of old style, and who are some of the makers of that? And then how does Plymouth gin, how is it similar or different to that kind of London dry style gin?
The first good gin was obviously London gin. And London gin traditionally has a lot of juniper berries, uses lots of different herbs and spices that are quite bitter in flavor, and really was the beginning of English gin's history. Now, Plymouth differs because it's made on the coast of Devon, which is the region in England where Plymouth is. And it was invented as a gin for the British Royal Navy. What happened is, of course, the Dutch gins were a lot softer than the London gins, and the sort of navy and the soldiers of those regions were asking for something softer. And so Mr. Coates came up with the idea of making a gin with no bitter flavoring. And that would be what's fundamentally different.
So when you use Plymouth gin, which is, as you say, a softer gin, has less bitterness, in a cocktail, what happens to the finish of that cocktail? And I guess let's talk about a martini.
Plymouth, to me, is the quintessential martini gin. I think that because of the no bitter botanicals, it has a softer palate. What bitter gins tend to do is they tend to jump to the back of the mouth. Plymouth, because of its sweet botanicals, tends to jump forward, making it a rounder flavor.
Now, we're talking about martini. How did it get its name? Do you know?
I would say that the most popular reason it was called the martini was because of a bartender who had the same name, who was making drinks at the Knickerbocker Hotel. And he kind of popularized that cocktail.
And how did it get its reputation as the cocktail of the swanky jet set? Was that James Bond's doing?
Well, James Bond definitely has a lot to do with it. I think there's a lot of people that made the martini cool. Of course, you have people like Winston Churchill and Roosevelt loved their martinis. And once upon a time, politicians and royalty were certainly trendsetters. They were drinking martinis in what we would call the famous martini lunch, you know, or they used to call it the three martini lunch.
I don't even know how that's possible.
Not anymore. I totally agree. Actually, the three martini lunch is one of my theories as to why vodka came in and beat gin out as the number one white spirit of the world. Because, of course, people were drinking martinis at lunch going back to work. And vodka had a very clever way of saying, if you drink vodka, no one will detect the alcohol. Obviously, James Bond was, to me, one of the greatest drinkers. And I don't say that in the alcoholic way. I actually say that he was a sophisticated drinker. He ordered the best cocktails. Even if you look at Casino Royale, the first cocktail he orders in that book is the Americano, which is a great cafe cocktail that was being made with Campari in the streets of Italy. And of course, James Bond goes on to invent a martini called the Vesper Martini in that same book, which is named after the famous Russian spy Vesper Lind.
So we should definitely be ordering our martinis shaken, not stirred?
Absolutely not. In fact, I heard...
Oh, interesting.
No, I don't know what Ian Fleming was trying to do when he said that. Because I know a bartender called Gilberto. He's retired now, but he used to work in the Duke's Hotel in London, and he used to serve Ian Fleming a lot. And he always was adamant that Ian Fleming had his martini stirred. So why he wrote shaken, not stirred, I'm not quite sure. But as a rule of thumb, a lot of bartenders believe that if it's made of just alcohol, all it needs is stirring, and stirring it with ice will dilute it just nicely, but it won't cloud it, it won't break chips of ice into it, and it will give you a very silky, smooth martini. But as soon as you start shaking it, you've heard the term bruise the gin. Essentially, if you shake it, you see it cloud up, you see shards of ice in it. It's not very attractive to look at, and certainly it breaks the oils out of the gin and is not as balanced. So until you put fruit in it, until you put cream in it, it should be stirred, not shaken.
Simon, this has really been wonderful. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Evan. Thank you.
Simon Ford is from Plymouth Gin. We'll have some recipes for a slow gin fizz and some other gin drinks on our website at kcrw.com. Click on the talk menu and find Good Food. While you're on the site, check out the brand new Good Food video podcast. Each month or so, I'll be showing you certain techniques and cooking tips, basically all the stuff that's impossible to do on the radio. Speaking of liquor, absinthe was a liquor that took France by storm in the 19th and 20th century. It was believed to be so addictive that it was banned up until the 1990s. Now a revival of this emerald green spirit is taking hold. I'll talk with a correspondent who sampled a number of these new absinthes. Absinthe, that bohemian green spirit with such a history of romance and intrigue. What do we know about it? Well, not much. That's why we've asked Louisa Chu, our correspondent since 2002, to stop in. Louisa's based out of Paris and Chicago. Her award-winning blog is movable-feast.com, my favorite, and she recently attended an absinthe tasting in Paris. So, Louisa, let's start at the beginning. Tell us what absinthe is.
Absinthe itself is a distilled liquor made from the base of the grand absinthe plant, which is related to tarragon. And if you taste it, it actually has somewhat of that sort of very astringent kind of minty, distinctive minty taste. It's actually a drink that's still illegal in the United States.
Now, why is it illegal? I didn't hear you say the famous words that seem to always be connected with absinthe, which is wormwood.
Yes, actually, wormwood is just one of the names for the grand absinthe plant. It's supposedly the herb that creates the active ingredient absinthe that drives people mad. It's the famous drink that supposedly made Van Gogh so mad that he cut off his own ear. Absinthe was actually at one point as common as a cup of coffee. I mean, imagine a drink that was so popular that there were absinthe hours. There was l'heure verte, which is literally the green hour, which was around 5 o'clock every evening. People would stop on their way home from work and get a glass of absinthe at an absinthe cafe. It was a perfectly respectable drink. However, for various political reasons, not the least of which is perhaps some wine-growing pressure in France, there needed to be a scapegoat for a certain kind of drink. And absinthe was the one that became it. So it was actually targeted because it was such a popular, relatively inexpensive drink for the working class.
How interesting. Okay, now let's talk about this tasting. How many did you get to taste?
I actually survived tasting 20 different kinds of absinthe.
During the course of how long?
Over the course of about 2 hours.
Wow.
I made very good use of the spit bucket.
And tell me how you drank it.
The traditional way of drinking absinthe is to pour a dose or shot, which is still about 1 ounce of absinthe, into a glass, and then to drip ice cold water into the absinthe. And it's important that the water drops from a fair height and then hits the absinthe itself to bring the herbal oils out of solution. And so when those herbal oils come out of solution, they actually make the somewhat translucent green absinthe a cloudy white. And sugar is optional. For very fine absinthe, though, it's usually not taken with sugar. But sugar is perfectly acceptable, and actually is one of the traditional ways of having absinthe is by putting a flat slotted absinthe spoon across the top of your glass and then a sugar cube and then dropping water down onto the sugar cube, which would then melt through the spoon into your glass.
So it has this great ritual aspect of consumption.
Absolutely. And I mean, that has always been historically one of the biggest attractions of drinking absinthe is the ritual. And it's almost meditative.
What were like the top two absinthes that you tasted? And were they very old, sort of venerable distillers, or were they new?
Actually, I had the opportunity to taste two really remarkable absinthes, really on completely opposite sides of the spectrum. The first absinthe that I had a chance to taste was one that dated back pre-ban. It was the early 1900s. This was an amazing drink. Absinthe, because of its herbal compounds, typically does have that really distinct green color. But as it ages in this bottle, being nearly 100 years old, the color ages like a leaf. It turns somewhat mellow and golden, and the flavors, you know, I mean, do something similar too. They kind of get richer and deeper. It's so incredibly herbal and natural and intoxicating. And that's what it originally was created for, was to be an herbal elixir.
And what about the next one? Was the next one you really loved, a more modern distilling?
The other bottle that I had, which was absolutely amazing, was made by Ted Brough. Ted's an American chemist from a long line in New Orleans, chased out by Katrina, who became a big absinthe fan, was curious about it, and so reverse engineered it in his own lab in his spare time. So he's made now some of the most highly prized absinthe in the world. One of the newest drinks that he has is a white absinthe. It was just so incredibly soothing. It was something really more along the lines of an herbal tonic than a hard drink.
Given that there is this ban, do we get to actually be able to taste in America Ted's absinthe?
There's a funny loophole in American law when it comes to absinthe. It is illegal to sell, but it is legal to possess and to drink it. And so you can actually purchase all of Ted's absinthe through the website absintheonline.com.
Thank you so much, Louisa.
Thank you so much, Evan.
That was Louisa Chu, our marvelous correspondent, based in Paris and in Chicago. Her award-winning blog is movable-feast.com. We all know that McDonald's are everywhere around the world. But how does that happen? Is the love of French fries so universal that they can just cross all cultures? Next, I'll explore the cultural aspect of American fast food chains, what works and what doesn't. That's when Good Food continues on KCRW and KCRW.com. Relationship of food to cultures is complex. In its industrialized form, it has enormous power, not just to make a profit or to make us fat, but cultural power, especially when American industrialized food giants make their way abroad. Could it be that the cultural power exported by companies like McDonald's has more power than all of our diplomacy and philanthropic programs combined? James L. Watson has been a professor of anthropology at Harvard since 1989. His book, Golden Arches East, McDonald's in East Asia, has just come out in a second edition. It's had a profound impact on conversation about cultural influence abroad. Hi, James. It's wonderful to have you here on Good Food.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Could you talk about how many McDonald's there are in America versus abroad in China?
Well, there's fast catching up. The international market, the non-United States market for McDonald's now essentially is the tail that wags the dog in terms of profits. So I think it's probably a good idea to focus more on the future of the market. And it's very clear if you look at McDonald's that the future of their market is going to be places like China and various other regions of the world where things are still continuing to expand.
Let's talk about McDonald's in China. How long ago did they enter there?
They've been there since the early 90s. That first open market for McDonald's was in the special economic zone of Shenzhen, which is right above Hong Kong. But it really didn't take off until it began in Beijing, probably in the mid-1990s, when the market really began to expand.
Let's talk a little bit about what they look like. Is the signage in Chinese or is it in English?
Well, that's a very interesting question. If you look at McDonald's history in Hong Kong, it gives you a good idea of how the company has approached this question of representing itself in a foreign society. It began in Hong Kong by only having English signage. It was called McDonald's in English and there was no Chinese characters. They only introduced the term McDalo, which is Cantonese for McDonald's, probably about 10 or 12 years after they have actually began to set up the market and people began to recognize it as an institution. And at that point, they began to introduce Chinese menus and Chinese signage.
What I'm fascinated is this sort of flipped paradigm where the initial excitement and interest in it was almost purely cultural because the food that's being sold is not really a food that was particularly appealing or familiar to Chinese people. Isn't that right?
Well, certainly in China proper and Beijing, of course, McDonald's primary fare, which is the burger and the fries and the Coke, were not really very recognizable, except, of course, for the Coca-Cola, which had been in China for many years, even prior to the revolution. What happened is that McDonald's presented itself as a total experience, and many people approached McDonald's as a taste of the West and a means of connecting themselves to globalization. So many people would take their kids to McDonald's and sit them down and give them a burger and a fries, stand around and watch the kid eating, and hope that the kid would connect with the globe. So eating was perceived by many Chinese consumers as a very important part of becoming global. The food was quite secondary at the beginning. That's now changing as McDonald's becomes localized.
Is it true that part of the core product that they were selling was really the environment? Being in a clean, air-conditioned, sort of rather cheerful, like this forced sort of cheerful space, these kind of spaces weren't very common in China at the time.
No, they were very uncommon, and that was also true in Taiwan. It was true in Hong Kong. And I think for many people, including teenagers at the beginning and also older people, it was quite clear that this was almost more important than the food itself.
Now, there are some people, some academics, that have seen this sort of entrance of this industrialized giant into the Chinese market as a new form of imperialism.
Yes, it is called the cultural imperialism hypothesis. The idea is that corporations like McDonald's can come into a society and wipe out the local cuisine and local culture and in its place represent a new form of global culture, thereby adding to the profits of the corporation. This is a very widely accepted theory among American and European academics. I must admit that probably before I began my own ethnographic anthropological study of McDonald's, I may have very much shared some of these views. But the more I dug into the local questions, the more it became clear to me that this is very much a part of the perception of the beholder as opposed to what people on the ground actually feel. It's not at all the case that people who find themselves in McDonald's are the puppets of international corporations dancing on the strings of people pulling from abroad. In fact, they're usually there for their own reasons, and they have their own purposes, and they have their own agenda. The idea that something like McDonald's can come into a society as complicated as China and somehow undermine the local culture and insert a form of American culture in its place, I think is quite silly, frankly. The one way to think about this is to look at social change like a train that's pulling its way through a society. Now, you have to ask yourself, what is the locomotive and what is the caboose? Many theorists of the cultural imperialism hypothesis argue that McDonald's is like the locomotive, that it can change a society by bringing in social change, whereas it's clear from my own research and that of others that McDonald's is more like the caboose, that it actually follows social change rather than creates social change. There's no way at all that McDonald's could have possibly been successful in a place like China, Taiwan, or Hong Kong prior to the changes in the social system that led to small families and the rise of a middle class. That had to come first, and then McDonald's can follow after.
It's so fascinating talking to you. We definitely have to do this again. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you for having me.
James Watson is a professor at Harvard. He's written a book on this topic. It's Golden Arches East, McDonald's in East Asia. Speaking of McDonald's, have you ever wondered what makes chicken McNuggets into those perfectly round, extremely non-natural chicken shapes? Well, it's meat glue. Meat glue's also made its way into the laboratory gastronomy movement. I'll tell you all about this high-tech edible compound next when Good Food continues. There are those who are saying that the new fine cooking is being increasingly divided into two camps. On one side, there are those who rely on the ingredients to speak for themselves in their traditional form, and for whom seasonal, artisanal, and often cultural associations of food are paramount. Then there are those whose kitchens have begun to resemble gastronomic laboratories. These extraordinary chefs are playing with liquid nitrogen, foams, sous vide cooking, and meat glue. What was that you say? Did I actually say meat glue? Well, it's easier to say than transglutaminase. Harold McGee, noted food scientist and author of On Food and Cooking and The Curious Cook, is going to be our guide this morning through the world of sticking different proteins together. Hi, Harold.
Good morning, Evan.
So tell us what this meat glue is and how it's made.
Okay, it's an enzyme, and enzymes are, in all living things, they're sort of the chemical machinery that gets things done, gets things made and unmade in our bodies and in plants, in bacteria, in everything. And transglutaminase, meat glue, was first discovered in guinea pigs, I think, back in the 50s. And it's an enzyme that basically takes two different strands of protein and forms a bond between them.
Could you tell us the history of transglutaminase, its use in the food industry in particular?
Well, until an easier source of the enzyme was found than the liver of guinea pigs, it was not an economical thing to experiment with. But it was in the 1980s that a Japanese scientist found a soil microbe that produces lots of a molecule that's very much like the original one that was found, similar enough that they just called it transglutaminase as well. It does exactly the same thing, but it comes from a microbe instead. And so what that meant was that people could take that microbe into a factory and essentially treat it the way you would treat, say, yeast in brewing or producing yeast for baking. You just grow tons and tons of this microbe in fermenters and extract the transglutaminase enzyme from the fermentation broth and then purify it. And then you've got this powder that is pure transglutaminase and relatively inexpensive. And then in the 1990s, people began to experiment with it and find uses for it. The slang term for it, meat glue, is just a really good description for what it does. It takes two different proteins, binds them together, and so it's really good at taking pieces of protein and binding them together as well. So, for example, if you think about what's called in the industry restructured meat, which you might think of as
Chicken McNuggets?
Yeah, Chicken McNuggets or Spam, Spam-like creations.
Give us some uses that some fine chefs have found for it.
Well, the ones that I'm aware of are things like this. You can, for example, take a sardine and very carefully bone it so that you've removed the backbone and the ribs and so on by cutting it in half and taking the bones out. And then you can use a little bit of meat glue and very carefully glue those two pieces back together again. So you now have what looks like the intact original sardine, but in fact it's boneless and you can just pop the whole thing in your mouth. So that's something that I've had at the Fat Duck in England. And then you can do things like take, say, a piece of duck and a piece of pork and stick them together so that they're one block of meat. Half of it tastes like duck, half of it tastes like pork, and then you can go ahead and cook it in a variety of ways.
Wow, it's just it's so interesting because it just really skirts the edge of something that could be incredibly intellectually fabulous as a taste sensation and a total horror story.
Yes. Well, I really do think that it depends on the hands that are using it and the uses to which it's being put.
Does it negatively affect the digestion of the foods that it's in for us?
No, because being a protein, it's like any other protein in our food. And in fact, we eat transglutaminase every day in all the other things that we eat. It's just that it hasn't been extracted and used by the cook to make something. It's just in the cells of the food. So when we cook it, in fact, the enzyme is broken, it's denatured, and then our bodies just take it and break it down into its individual amino acids, and then we recycle those and use those to build our own proteins, including our own transglutaminase.
Now, what about the caloric value, the basic nutritional value of this strange glue?
Well, being a protein, its nutritional value is exactly the same as any other protein. So it has a few calories per gram and provides us with amino acids. So it is nutritious in that sense, in addition to doing the sculptural job that it does in the hands of the experimental cooks.
Well, thank you so much. This has been really interesting. I appreciate you taking the time to be with us.
My pleasure, Evan. Thank you.
Chefs all over the country call on food scientist Harold McGee. His book on food and cooking is a great reference for the amazing chemistry that takes place in the kitchen. Another chemistry miracle that happens in the kitchen is bread making. Yeast, flour, and water can be transformed into incredible sustenance. I'll be back next to inspire you to get baking. That's in 1 minute right here on Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. You've done some baking, even made some bread, but you haven't yet made the leap to feeding wild yeasts and keeping your own personal starter in the fridge. Maybe it's time. So meet your new mentor, Peter Reinhardt. Peter Reinhardt's a baking instructor at Johnson & Wales University. He was the co-founder of the legendary Brother Juniper's Bakery in Sonoma, California, and is the author of 5 books on bread baking. I've been poring over his latest in paperback, Crust and Crumb, Master Formulas for Serious Bread Bakers, for the past few weeks. Hi, Peter. I'm so glad that you're here.
Well, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Now, the thing that fascinates me about bread, I mean, one of the main things that fascinates me, of course, is the yeast. Is there really a starter yeast that passes from hand to hand?
Well, yeah, you can actually do that. Once you create a starter, some people call them sourdough starters or wild yeast starters, you can keep them alive indefinitely by just feeding them on a regular schedule. The starter that they use at the Boudin Bakery, for instance, in San Francisco, which is probably the oldest and most famous of the San Francisco sourdough bakeries, they started in 1849, right in time for the gold rush. And they've kept that starter alive the whole 150-plus years since.
It seems like such an enormous commitment.
Well, you know, it does in one sense because you have to be – it's on your mind. But I think once people get into it and they get a rhythm going, you can actually feed a starter, let it rise for a couple hours, put it in the refrigerator and forget about it for as long as you want. It'll still be good for 2 or 3 days. And if you go longer than that, you can just take a small piece and build it back up again and start with a fresh one. I've had starters in my refrigerator for months that I haven't used, and I just sort of let them go dormant. And they're not usable after a few weeks because the acids that are in the starter eat the starter up so that the only thing left there is like a mush. But in the mush are all these living organisms, yeast and bacteria that are all necessary for the starter. So you just take a small amount of that, about you could take 1 ounce of that old starter and add 4 or 5 ounces of flour to that and a few ounces of water, and suddenly you've got 6 ounces of a new starter, and that 6 ounces could be turned into 3 pounds of starter, you know, within the next day. So it's very easy to build it back. And I think that's part of the fascination and why there's such an interest right now in home baking and artisan baking, is there's this craft quality where you're working with living organisms, and the bread bakers like it because they're kind of flying without a net. They don't have the same predictability as you would with yeast, where you buy commercial yeast and you know in 90 minutes it's going to double in size. With wild yeast, you have to kind of feel your way into it, and it gives you much more sense of that craftsmanship.
As you said, that this sort of world of artisan bread has just exploded in this country. Could you talk a little bit about the basic types of world-class bread and what you mean by world-class?
Sure. Well, one thing, of course, is it's always about flavor. In the end, what differentiates good from great, especially in food, is the sense of flavor. And we've grown up in this country with bread for, you know, our whole lives. And the bread has never been great until recently. We were willing to settle for average bread because it was inexpensive. The economics worked for us. Bread bakeries could crank out thousands and thousands of loaves very easily. The sacrifice was that we weren't getting the full flavor that was potentially in that flour. And I tell my students on the first day of class that their mission is to evoke the full potential of flavor trapped in the flour. And everything else that they're going to learn during those 22 days is about how to pull that potential flavor out. So when we became exposed in the last, you know, 20, 25 years to the European caliber breads that were coming over from some of the great bakers there, or Americans who had gone to Europe and experienced great bread, we realized that there was this other level of bread, of flavor, of potential that we weren't tapping into. And then the American bread movement kind of jumped in to respond to that. We certainly have a number of bakeries that can produce bread of that caliber. Los Angeles, of course, is famous for La Brea breads. And that's a great example of a small little artisan bakery that kind of grew into a giant bakery because of savvy business sense.
There are a couple of questions I wanted to ask you about actually making doughs. Is it possible to make a good dough using a food processor, or do we have to do everything by hand?
Yeah, actually, there was a book that came out about 8 or 9 years ago called The Best Bread Ever, a great title for a book, by Charles Van Over, in which the whole technique of the book is based on mixing it in a food processor. The whole purpose of mixing is just to essentially combine the ingredients and activate the yeast and develop the gluten. And you can do that in a lot of different ways. The food processor does it very quickly. So the one cautionary note for anybody using a food processor to mix their dough is to just kind of pulse the dough and not turn it on for a long period of time, because it will heat up very quickly. I never mix for more than about 45 seconds. Then I just turn the machine off, let it sit for about 5 minutes so that the dough has a chance to kind of absorb all the liquid. And then I turn it back on again for a few more seconds just to kind of finish it off.
Now, the title of your book that's the latest to come out in paperback is Crust and Crumb Master Formulas for Serious Bread Bakers. I really wanted to ask you what the difference is between a formula and a recipe, and why did you make that decision to call them formulas?
That's a great question, because, again, one of the first things we tell our students is that as bakers, they're going to be stepping out of the realm of recipes. A recipe, there's still recipes in the book. A recipe is a very specific quantity of ingredients that will eventually turn into a food product. But a formula is really about the relationship between the ingredients. And one of the things that the American baking community has learned during this Renaissance period of breads is that European bakers bake by percentages. Everything is a ratio of flour to water, or flour to yeast, or flour to salt. And when you understand the ratios, you could really create hundreds and hundreds of different breads just on paper by knowing what ratios work. Then you can figure out the amount of the ingredients and make a recipe based on that formula, and then test it once and make a couple final tweaks, and suddenly you've got a brand new bread.
Peter, it's been so interesting. Thank you.
Oh, it's my pleasure.
Peter Reinhardt is the author, most recently, of Crust and Crumb, Master Formulas for Serious Bread Bakers. We'll have some recipes online at kcrw.com. Click on the Talk menu and scroll down to Good Food. Earlier in the show, we talked about fast food. Fast food is full of trans fats, that plastic-type fat that scientists believe is really, really bad for us. New York City is taking on this fat head-on by banning trans fats in the city. But is this really practical? And who is it going to affect the most? When Good Food returns, I'll find out some answers. We've all heard the phrase trans fats, and lately we've been told with greater frequency and urgency that the best thing we can do for ourselves is cut them out of our diet with a zero tolerance policy. Since we're apparently not being good little boys and girls, some cities are contemplating protecting us from ourselves by instituting bans on trans fats. With us this morning to talk about the New York City ban on the bad fats is Kim Severson, a staff writer for the New York Times and co-author with Cindy Burke of The Trans Fat Solution, Cooking and Shopping to Eliminate the Deadliest Fat from Your Diet, a book, by the way, that Newsweek called a masterwork of service journalism. So I'm curious, what precipitated the New York City Council decision to explore banning trans fats?
I think there's a lot of effort on the part of public officials these days to figure out what to do with our diets. And that's kind of the backstory on this. The obesity crisis, school lunches, public agencies are increasingly trying to police what we eat. And you can certainly look at the foie gras ban that the Chicago City Council recently instituted. There's a similar one in California. So I think this comes out of that civic movement that's happening right now. Now, trans fats, of course, are an easy target. And certainly most consumers have seen zero trans fat on all the manufactured food products and the Oreos and that sort of thing in the supermarkets. And that came from an FDA requirement that food manufacturers label trans fat amounts that started last January. So all the food companies, instead of wanting to say we have 5 grams of trans fat, decided they wanted to say we have zero trans fat. And so that really effectively got trans fat into the minds of all kinds of people.
What is a trans fat?
Trans fat is the only artificial fat that we eat. You're taking a polyunsaturated fat, relatively healthy, and sending it through a chemical process to make it act like a saturated fat, to make it a fat that will stay solid at room temperature. Now, the reason they call it trans is that they stop the process in the middle from turning it from a polyunsaturated to a saturated fat. So they stop it halfway and call it trans so that it'll stay soft and creamy, because if they were to fully hydrogenate it, it'll be like as hard as candle wax, and you can't really cook or manufacture Triscuits or whatever with that.
If we take a natural saturated fat, like lard or butter, and we compare it to trans fat, which one is healthier for us?
Well, saturated fat, as we've all learned, increases the bad cholesterol in your body and clogs your arteries and can lead to heart attacks. Trans fat takes things one step further. It increases the bad cholesterol, but also lowers the good cholesterol, and that's the other substance in your blood that kind of helps scrub your arteries clean. So cholesterol kind of has two sides. That's kind of the well-proven, government-accepted science. And there is a whole bunch of other science that is vetted in various degrees that says that trans fat does other things to your body. Because it's an artificial fat, your body doesn't know how to process it. And so a doctor explained it to me like it's like if you have a watch and you put a few grains of sand in it. The watch won't stop working immediately, but eventually enough of those grains of sand will stop the clock from working, and trans fat act like those grains of sand in your body.
So would this ban mostly affect fast food restaurants?
What you're really going to find this is in the diner. You know, if they are making you a grilled cheese, oftentimes they'll take something sort of generically called a griddle mix or a grill mix and spread that on the grill. Certainly, bakery products, frosting. The frosting on a lot of cakes is made with shortening. The other thing it might affect, and this is a great icon of New York food, is the black and white cookie. This is kind of a cake-like cookie that's got half chocolate frosting and half a kind of lemony vanilla frosting. And the recipe for that calls for a lot of shortening to make that cake-like cookie. So there are a few icons that are going to fall. Certainly the fast food French fries, things deep fried, that's where we get a lot of our trans fat. And the other thing is even if you take – if you use a trans fat-free oil to fry it in, a lot of frozen French fries come in and they've been sort of coated with oil that has trans fat. So this is a change that will have to happen all the way down the supply line to the French fry factories in Idaho.
Now, why are the New York Food Bank and the Latino Restaurant Association opposed to the ban?
For the food bank, a lot of it is just, you know, there's a lot of hungry people. A little trans fat is better than going hungry. There's a sense that, you know, they will cut a large part of the supplies they receive from federal agencies or private donors. People are afraid it will cost jobs. There's some federal trade concerns going on, interstate trade issues. Will McDonald's have to make a set of fries just for New York City audiences? And then there's some people who believe that trans fat may not be as bad as everybody seems to think. If you recall when we all got off of saturated fat and went on to margarine in the 80s, at that time people thought somehow that partially hydrogenated oil was better for you than butter. That's trans fat. And many doctors recommended it. Now those doctors feel badly, but they're saying that the science shows that actually the margarine is worse for you than the butter. Although through all of this, I should say limiting saturated fat is still a good idea for your heart.
Kim Severson is a New York Times reporter. She's also an authority on the subject of trans fats. Her book, The Trans Fat Solution, Cooking and Shopping to Eliminate the Deadliest Fat from Your Diet, explains how insidious this fat is in this country. There's another food-related ban taking place, this one in Glendale, near L.A. Commercial outdoor grilling has been against the law for years, but it's now being enforced. Particularly hard hit by this ordinance is the area's large Armenian community, where grilled foods are an important part of the cuisine. I'll be back next to talk about this effect and what's really at stake. That's when Good Food returns. Imagine sometime in the future, you live in a small city in the U.S., a city, well, maybe like Glendale. It's Sunday and the family's gathered for a barbecue. The smell of beef charring is firing up appetites, and the men of the group are contentedly tending the fire. There's a knock on the door. It's the police to tell you that you're now under arrest for outdoor grilling. Well, the future seems to be now as the city of Glendale begins to enforce its ban on outdoor grilling. With us this morning is Ara Najarian. Ara's a lawyer by day and a Glendale City Council member by night. He's also one of 85,000 Armenians in the city of Glendale. Why do we mention his ethnicity? Well, the link between Armenians and grilled meat is sort of legendary. Welcome, Ara.
Thank you for having me.
Well, first, let's talk a little bit about Armenian cooking. Give me a little bit of some history. Is outdoor grilling an important part of the cuisine?
It's a very important part. I've traveled to Armenia 3 times in the last 10 or 15 years, and there is no better way for an Armenian family to extend and to display their hospitality to a guest than to have a delicious outdoor barbecue dinner with meats and foods that they have taken from their own farms and their own communities, and to present them to their guests in the best way possible.
Is outdoor grilling always integral to these festivities?
Almost always it's an integral part of it. The traditions that I observed in Armenia firsthand are carried over to the United States and the communities where the Armenians have settled, and it's the way of preserving their culture and their heritage. And it is their belief that there is no better way to show hospitality, again, by having large gatherings and for the hosts to lavish upon their guests the very best of foods and drink and entertainment. And the integral part of that is the kebab.
So what is the problem? Is it the wafting smoke?
That's what we began to hear probably about 2 years ago. We began to hear, as a city council, complaints from residents saying, I'm just getting overtaken with the smoke from the barbecue grills in several high-profile locations.
Now, I understand that ban has actually been on the books for a while, but it hasn't really been a high priority in terms of enforcement.
That's true. Actually, it's not an outright ban on outdoor grilling. Our city laws have delineated certain categories of activities which are permissible. And unfortunately, outdoor grilling and barbecuing was not listed years and years ago when the ordinance was developed as a permissible activity. And it's perhaps that many, many years ago, outdoor grilling and barbecuing was not an issue. And it's as the Armenian community began to develop and grow in Glendale, that's when the grilling began and the complaints of the smoke came forward and someone checked the books. And lo and behold, there was no category which permitted outdoor grilling.
Where does it put you council members who are both council members and Armenian?
Well, it puts us really in the middle of the situation. What we tried to develop was what we felt was a compromise that would both protect the rights of the residents as well as those folks who really demanded and relished the authentic taste of an outdoor barbecued kebab. And we set several restrictions. We set limits on the size of the barbecue. We set limits on the distance between the barbecue and the residential zones. And it was our hope that by passing this ordinance, we would permit barbecuing and we'd be closely regulating it to see if those restrictions were sufficient to alleviate issues of the smoke that the neighbors were complaining about. Unfortunately, because it's a land use issue, the council needed 4 votes. We only got 3. So our attempt to create a compromise failed.
Do you think that this ban could eventually extend to residential grilling?
Well, those folks that are very sensitive to the smoke issue and who say that we're polluting the air quality of not just Glendale, but the region and surrounding cities, if taken to its next logical step, they should not see any differentiation between commercial grilling and doing their backyard barbecue.
I see a slippery slope developing.
That's where it's leading us.
So now that many of our listeners have started to become hungry just at the words grilling, kebab, charred meat, give us the name of some of the restaurants that we should look out for while we're in Glendale, some of your favorite places.
One of my favorites is Anoush Restaurant. There's the Verdugo Hills Country Club, Elena's Armenian and Greek Food. Carousel is very tasty. And I've stated that I don't think you can find finer Armenian cuisine anywhere in the state, perhaps the country, than what we have right here in Glendale.
Thanks a lot, Ara.
Thank you very much.
That was Ara Najarian, an attorney and also a member of the Glendale City Council. We've been talking about the City of Glendale ban on outdoor grilling. You can find out all the info from today's show at kcrw.com. Search Good Food or click on the talk menu. The show can be podcast, too. Go to iTunes or kcrw.com for details. Don't forget to check out our new podcast. The executive producer of Good Food is Jennifer Farrow. This show is produced by Thea Challoner with Bob Carlson, Marina McLeod, Candace Moyer, Priya Fenimore, and Holly Tarson. I'm Evan Kleinman. I hope you'll tune in again next week for another edition of Good Food.